Hi, and welcome to the Break It Till You Make It podcast. My name is Frank Farrell, and I'll be your host. I'm also the author of the thesis by the same name.
Okay, I have with me Maj Chabaita, who's a maker and an artist in the Digital Futures program. And I have with me Omid Ithiadi, who's also an artist and a maker. And we are all graduating amidst this pandemic in 2020. So all of the fantastic work that has been created and all the installations are now flat images that we have to create and put on a website. So we just wanted to talk about, the overlap between our projects. And since we all made things and we approaching making in different ways, it had been really interesting because we have been riffing off each other in terms of ideas and even helping each other in terms of documentation. And I think, Maz, if you want to just talk about your project a little bit and let guys know what it's all about.
Sure. So my project talks about how the knowledge, the intervention point of my project is really about the knowledge of making and how it's been slowly wearing away from people. And what that is causing us is to rely fully on manufacturers, on whatever they provide for us, tools and technology to do things. And it's also having the same, cycle effect of that reliance is also elongating and extending our lack of knowledge of our devices and stuff. And this is where my project gets in, is talking about bringing back that knowledge and bringing it in an everyday activity and starting with small things and starting with resources that are already available at home, from electronic waste or things that are just obsolete. And it's just sort of talking about making an everyday accessible activity for everybody, not just makers.
You want to talk a little bit about that fantastic contraption and at the back of you that I can see. I mean, maybe talk people through what it is, because nobody can see it right now. But
For my thesis project, I created Liberated Debris, which is a project that positions making in a protest position, protesting the rise of electronic waste, protesting the lack of knowledge of how these devices work. And so I created three musical instruments made almost entirely from electronic waste, or just things that are, we tend to keep throughout the years, because there isn't really a good way to recycle or get rid of our electronic devices. And so most of us end up just hoarding them, keeping them at home. And so I created these projects from those resources that are available at home.
I just really want to touch upon just how you got inspired on this whole idea of protest, because you went to Lebanon at the beginning of the term and disappeared. And we are like, where is Maz gone? And he's like gone to protest in Lebanon with all his other... do you have family there?
Yeah. So yeah. All my family there. I grew up there. And it's an interesting place, because in many ways, life there is a form of protest. Survival is our resistance. And wow. So it's in every aspect. And I want to, like, maybe for this conversation, the most relevant part is the technology part. And, for us growing up, we didn't have open access to technology. We usually get things that later than the rest of the world, by the time the technology gets to us, it's already older technology. Yeah. In other parts of the world. And so this way of interacting with it allowed us to just kind of develop, some skills to hack it and extend its life. Yeah. And so you'll have cars and machines that are you know, tweaked and fixed and, you know, even upgraded by its owners. And yeah, like a lot of times you'll get, you know, a new car and an old car and get parts of a newer car, put them in an older car, and, you know, you make it work somehow.
And you always brought back, you know, your whole journey with your grandfather. And I read a little bit of your document and I found that so, I mean, that was a real emotional connection, but also like he really inspired you through this whole journey because you were reflecting upon something maybe you wouldn't think about, but like in retrospect, is like he was the one who lit the spark, right?
Right. I mean, he's the one who sort of gave a context for me. This is like, that's the way people were doing things in Lebanon, but he spoke to me about it. He explained it, why, and he gave it context and reason and logic. And that was very inspiring for me because I think after moving to this part of the world, I thought things were being done differently here. But after moving here, I realized that that way of thinking, that way of living is actually most needed here, because here is where you get all the technology all the time, fully accessible, fully available for you. And capitalism is at its peak here. And yeah. So you get this really, you know, crazy combination of greed and technology capacity. So I think people, especially people like us, but people in general, need to develop some skills and knowledge of how to interact with this world. It's not just knowing how to use the tools according to how the manufacturers tell us how. We need to figure out how, we need to figure out to what extent, we need to figure out, like, it's our stuff, it's our life, and we need to figure out how to deal with that and interact with that.
Yeah, and that comes to, like, you know, the sharing of things, like how do we share all this knowledge? And I think that's where Omid really shines, because he took on an ambitious project, because I let him speak to it, but one of the things he told me was, I don't like documenting. And then he goes ahead and then does a whole thesis on documentation. So Omid, how did that happen?
It's true. That's where I should begin. And I think for me, it was always a challenge to capture what I was doing in words or pictures or text. And that challenge came from like so many different reasons. Part of it was the fact that I was much more interested in the building rather than sitting down and writing about how I was building it.
Yeah.
And also part of it was because of the fact that I was improvising the whole time that I was making. It wasn't a set of rules that I was following. It was how I felt at that moment, what I needed to do based on what tools I had around me, based on what components I had around me. And it was never like a general idea of this is how you do this, so let's follow these steps to get there. But then again, at the same time, I looked up so many different people's project online, and they all seem to have a really logical steps of how to build those projects. I would look at them, I would never follow them, but they would give me ideas on what I needed to do. And I think going back to what Matt said, with building and making, there's a lot of things that's involved. You're there. You're trying to use whatever you have. You're there to use the tools that have been built for you to do things with. But then again, there is also a lot of learning that happens during that building process. Part of it is from your own experience. Part of it is by just learning some specific techniques of using some tools or a lot of different things. And for me, what really motivated me to do this project was that I kind of feel like human beings are losing the ability to reflect on things. And it can be very basic as to watching a TV show. You can always take away some kind of useful message if you really want to. But I think, and that task is really left for the person to do. The only thing that we can do in order to help the human being is to kind of provide them with more accurate or better description to let them make that lesson out of the stuff that they're seeing. So that's kind of the main motivation before for me to do this project.
So your project is unique in a sense because it's not just about documentation, right? You have taken a completely different angle for documentation where it's you're actually using physical objects to actually document things. And you're actually using the physicality of the object to actually touch the documentation in some ways. So if you can just share that in your way, I mean, that's what I understood it when I was interacting with your documentation method, right?
Yeah, I can give a short description of the project. So the project is really focused on a new method of interaction with documentation, specifically for physical objects. Part of the reason is that with the current market and the current stuff that are already out there, you can see a lot of online documentations, which are completely visual and on the internet, and they live outside of the physical object itself. So there's this lack of connection between the object that's actually built at the end and the documentation that goes into it. So they kind of live separate lives, and for a person to be able to fully understand an object, they need to study the object itself and then study the documentation separately. So with this project, what we wanted to do was to build a stronger connection between the documentation that went into the project, for example. So the basic three questions of what has been built, how it has been built, and why it has been built, and attach those information to the physical object. So my project is mostly the study itself, and we wanted to see the kind of opportunities that we can find and test those with people and see which one do they find more appealing for them to use. But at the end of it, it's, let me put it this way. For example, a 3D printed object, when you see a 3D printed object, if you have worked with 3D printers, it's pretty easy to identify them because you normally see the layers that have been printed. Yeah. And that's kind of like a physical indication on the physical object that tells you about how that object has been built. What we wanted to do was to expand on that and allow for people to attach more than just those basic information to the object. So that's why we designed these tags that it's kind of a mixture of physical and digital world where we design these physical tags that you can attach to a 3D printed model of your object. And you can use that as a way to interact with the documentation online.
Yeah. So for me, I took away things from both of your projects. I mean, you know, Maz, you helped me with, the maker cart and making it truly portable because, I mean, for you, it maybe have been a small thing just saying, oh, instead of screws, use bolts. But, you know, that came from your experience of actually working with huge scale prototypes. I remember right from, the first class, you would like be big or big or go home, you know, and create these, like we'd look at it and it's like, what the hell has he made? Like, you know, these huge fans, which you were transporting in your car. And then when it came to documentation, like, you know, I looked at what Omid was doing. And a lot of it was, you know, the reflective practice of, of actually making something and then, you know, writing about it in some way. And I think even for kids, it's very difficult for me to say that kids, it's easy for kids to document things. So one of the things we did was a stop motion workshop, right? Of the last class we did with kids. And I think the stop motion workshop was the easiest way for them to actually take pictures and document what they were doing, right? And that has become like a permanent installation at this community center. But I think thinking about these two aspects, because as makers, I'll just be honest, I don't like documentation.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, unless I really want to create a YouTube following or I really want to create, share this because it's an academic context, but I really love engaging with the physicality of, and I think Maz and Omid is in the same place. So, you know, we are literally like kind of, I don't know, forcing ourselves in some ways to actually adopt this new sense of making a whatever our process is visual so that other people can, like, you know, get some value out of it. And Maz, you had an interesting approach in your documentation where it's like 90% visual in some way, right?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you guys said 100%. I think the documentation part, especially the way we do it or the way we learned how to do it, it's in my opinion, it's to fit a certain academic requirement. And from my understanding, these requirements, these academic standards, or this academic rigor is really based on industry standards. And it's sort of, again, it's sort of a cycle that kind of feeds itself. This is the way industry does things. And so this is the way we're trained to do things. And we're trying to do things that are very, making is a very natural, very instinctive activity that humans make. And so trying to bridge this with this, it takes away that organic, natural process from it, and it makes it very calculated and studied. I find the same challenge. I make, like you said, Omid, I improvise a lot based on what's around me. And, you know, like, this is, for me, this is a very natural way of being, natural way of thinking. It's very difficult to capture that in scientific and academic terms. And you go, like, even when you come down and you write documentation, we're so trained to start to think of it in a certain way. Introduction, design, you know, like the same titles, the same structure. And it's,
And I mean, it's interesting that we all come from the East. I mean, and, like, you know, it's very communal in the way we share things over there. Like, you know, I come from India, and, like, you want to get to know somebody, you'll go to your neighbor's house, and they just come and they'll just do things with you. There's no, like, bringing some book and, like, computer. Like, I mean, of course, now they might be bringing in YouTube videos or whatever. I don't know. But, like, when growing up, it was like, you know, go call your uncle and let him get and come and get to fix this thing over here. Like, you know, and then you stand at the back and hand him the tools.
It is very communal. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
You share for the sake of sharing. It's even when you really think about it, knowledge itself is being attributed in a way, you know, like, you can't really say your thoughts anymore without citing some of them, and, like, attributing that knowledge to X person and Y person. And we don't really have that way of doing things. Knowledge is knowledge, and, you know, if you contribute with your part in that field, then that's what it is. It's a very different way of doing
mindset,
things. Very different mindset. My grandfather, when he was teaching me and others, he wasn't thinking of himself as in, like, these people will continue that knowledge and attribute it to him because he's the one who, you know, taught it to that person. No, it's not like that.
I mean, what has been your journey like with making? I mean, I know you love the maker culture and, you know, making, and, like, what has inspired you in this journey?
That's a really good question. I think it's part of the kind of family that I was raised in. It's the fact that for me, being a handyman, being able to fix your own issues, no matter how simple or big they were, that was a big deal, especially with the things that I used to do with my dad. Like, from the very beginning, whenever he was, like, building something or trying to fix something in our house, I was always there to help him. And as part of that, I kind of learned these skills that now when I compare myself to my friends, they seem to be, like, very essential things that you have to know. Like, I won't ask someone if they know how to do this. I just assume that everyone knows how to do this. But then I was like, I talked with my friends, and then I said, I did this, and they're all, like, shocked and surprised that, how did you do that? And I'm just like, you don't know how to do that? It's kind of surprising at the same time and shocking that there are, like, certain certain things that the biggest example for me was like it's stupid because I think what you all can relate to, but like learning how to use a bicycle. Yeah. That's a bicycle is something that I would never ask someone if you know how to ride a bike or not. It's one of those things that I was raised with, so it was never for me a question of someone knowing how to use a bike or not. Yeah. It was always like, let's go biking. And then I met with a few of my friends here and back in Dubai, and I was like, let's go for a ride. And they were like, we don't know how to ride a bike. And I was just like, okay. But the whole general thing, I think there's like this informal learning that happens.
Yeah.
When you take things in your own hand, when you open things up, when you try to fix things, when you try to build things for yourself, that's I think is essential. That's the word that I would use for it.
Yeah, it's also empowerment. I mean, like, you know.
It really is.
Yeah.
Like, and it's funny because I looked at the history behind documentation and stuff a bit, and like other people's work on documentation, and there were, I'm forgetting the name, but like for the task of DIY, I know that there's a Indian word for it that I don't remember the word, but
yeah.
Veda also bought me the book, and I read a few part of that book, and it's interesting to see this culture that it's not. Let me phrase it this way. There's a line that I read somewhere that I really loved, and I even used it in my thesis that says, you see, like, need isn't the mother of isn't the mother of creation anymore. It's not that you need something, therefore you build it. It's that you want something, therefore you build it for yourself.
Yeah,
it's kind of, I think it's gotten away from the days that like you had to survive, especially in the Western culture, that you have access to most things. It's not a question of lack of access to tools, but mostly it's about like just that power that you feel when you can solve your own issue.
Empowerment. It
really is.
It's empowerment.
Like, I had issues with my phone that broke down and gave it to repair shop, and they told me it was fully broken. Yeah. And then I tried to, and then I convinced myself to open it myself, and I was able to fix it.
Wow.
That was one of the most empowering moments in my life.
Yeah.
Right, because it's your phone, right?
Exactly. Your phone. And it's something that someone already told you that it's not fixable. So
it's not
the
possible.
Outside world doesn't want to fix it.
Yeah.
And then you open it yourself and you see what the issue is and you fix it.
And then they also tell you, you cannot fix it.
Exactly. I think that's one of the biggest part. That you realize the limitation of other people, like based on their agendas and their biases towards like fixing things. That's like a very simple example of it.
Yeah.
But I think that moment when I was able to fix my phone, that kind of really pushed me towards this kind of informal learning from YouTube, from watching other people work, from listening to other people's story, and just like being able to do what I want for myself.
Yeah.
Right.
So you also actually presented a paper in Australia recently, right?
Yes,
and
I did.
How did that go?
Not at all the way that I wanted it to go.
Okay.
It's I think so it's really nice because you go and you see this culture of people who are all interested in similar fields, and then you get to talk with them. It was really nice for me because I found a few people there that were doing works on documentation or were doing works on a new digital fabrication tools, which was really fascinating. But when it came to looking at the projects and looking, because you in a conference that you can only show limited things of your object, especially when it's in God knows where and you have to take an airplane to get there, and you can't really carry your actual prototype there. But I think the part that was really missing for me there was the style of documentation, because there were so many cool projects that people were talking about, like this completely new form of fabrication, and then they weren't able to bring the physical object, so we had to watch a video of how that object works. For me, that video never gave me like the full understanding that I wanted to get from that project. But at the same time, I was just like, oh my God, I love that project. I want to see more about it, but just this isn't enough. I need a bit more.
I mean, that's how we are presenting our own exhibition right now, you know, and it just feels like we are being cheated out of, like, putting our work out there for people to touch. And, I was just talking to Maz earlier before we started recording about how playing his instruments would be so much more effective. And, that sensation that you get when you interact with it, it can't be replicated through a video and like a still image, right?
No, I mean it's really difficult.
Maz, what was your experience with the Toronto future conference? What was it called? The Future of Making conference.
Yeah, Future of Making Unconference.
Unconference, okay. Yes.
Right. I mean, it was my first real experience within the maker culture.
Yeah, mine too in Toronto, and I was just talking to the guy who held conference yesterday, but I want to know, like, as a person who's attended it the first time, like, what was your experience like?
There's a lot of nice things about it, in the sense that it's just the first time I connect with the bigger maker community, the mainstream maker community in North America. I've heard a lot about it. I've studied a lot about it since I moved here. But this was my first real interaction, and there was a lot of nice moments in that convention, because I saw all kinds of people, young and old, and from all kinds of cultures, and it was nice, like, from that sense. But I didn't see. It was a lot of talking. It was a lot of discussing, but we didn't get to interact with any objects. We didn't get to see any objects.
It was more intellectual thing.
Right.
You were just talking about.
And I guess from that sense, it was missing for me.
Yeah.
But I was also glad not to see any commercial manufacturers there trying to sell stuff.
Oh, okay.
That's sort of what I heard a lot about maker fairs and maker communities, that it has become very commercial. There's a lot of companies advertising there for parts, for a lot of them are even sponsored by companies.
Yeah.
So I didn't see any of that, which was nice.
Well, where do you think you're going to take this stuff after you graduate, you think? And this is for you both, right?
Yeah. For me, I guess they're staying home for now. Now, COVID times, it's social distancing, so they're distancing also.
No, but I mean, this love for making, I mean, you are not going to stop making because graduation is done.
Oh, yeah.
And what are you going to do with all of these? Are you going to actually create more of them, display them, like create gallery installations?
I don't really look at my work as gallery work.
It is, though.
I guess in a sense, but like my work is the kind of work that is, constantly in process. It never, to me, my work never gets to a point where it's complete. It's done. There's always, that's just the way I am, so I don't know. I guess I see them more in a workshop setting.
And like yours is mainly driven by music. I mean, most of what you do is like, of course, you've done stuff with data in the past where you were actually taking data and converting it into physical installations. But mm-hmm. I think you're mainly inspired by music in some ways, right?
Right. Yeah. For me, I'm inspired by a lot of things. The way I saw my university opportunity is that I could work on things that I am interested in, regardless of how feasible or how efficient they are in a professional setting. So I identified that opportunity for me at the beginning, and I was like, so I'm gonna do everything that I love. I don't want to do anything that kind of makes sense. I don't want to do any product development and any of that. I might do that later, but for now I'm I'm just doing my own interests. And so music was one of them. And this was, I really wanted to explore the possibility that I could make something. So, and that's what I did.
Yeah. How about you, Amit? Where do you see your stuff going? Or, you, or what do you want to do ahead?
That's a really good question. The funny thing was that when this whole current situation happened, the first thing I told my dad was that I want to buy a router because I just think, because basically the first thing I was
I want to buy a router.
I want to, like, this is the time to learn new things. And then I was like, you know that, like, Harvard has their online course for, like, coding and programming. I was like, my dad was always interested in learning a bit more about programming. I was just like you can do that. And then I was like, but what do I want to learn? I was just like, I want to learn how to make something out of wood.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was just like, I need to find a tool that, like, does everything for me. And I was just like, I need to buy a router. it's like, for me, I see, like, the whole point of, like, making, and I think that will, that's something that it's just starting in me, and that's something that I think I have learned so much from it that I can't give it up. It's that
I think, yeah, we've all been, like, have the itch now, like the maker itch in
exactly
us, right?
And with the projects that we've done, I think they all have ignited something in us that, like, for me, just documentation, and I have looked at too many documentations, and I have looked at too many papers on documentations, and I just, like, I have found so many issues with it, and there are, like, so many troubles, that, so many things that have been identified by so many people, but no one does anything about them.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's my duty to do something about it.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, yeah, I think, yeah, it's fantastic. A fire.
I think we all spoke about, I think, also creating a makerspace of our own where we could just, like, you know, hang around and just make stuff. And, you know, and I live way out in the East End in Scarborough, and we don't have many makerspaces here. Like, all of the makerspaces are basically downtown and in, like, you know, in the West End. So I hope we can take that dream forward. And I know both of you have said, like, you are interested in doing it, and, you know, you're raising your hands up right now.
Yeah. No, the Fab Lab, I'm a big fan of the Fab Lab concept. I think in many ways, I don't know if it's perfect, but in many ways it's you know the very old concept of one, a single matchstick breaks quickly, but if you combine 20 of them and you come to break it, it becomes more difficult. Yeah. And I think that's what the Fab Lab is. I think it situates us as makers together, and together we're stronger, together we're smarter, together we will stay on for longer. And I think it almost positions us in an entity that's as strong as manufacturers, and I think that's very important.
Yeah,
that's very true.
Especially in times like this in Corona, where we can come in, we can become useful.
Yeah.
I think this current situation, there were, like, so many things that my friend recently, they had an issue in their house and something was leaking and they didn't know what to do. Like, at these times, they didn't know if, like, there's a store open or if they could call someone that could help them fix it. And my dad and I went over and we tried to help them to fix the leak, and thank God we did that. But I think at these points that you start to realize, like, you start to understand the value of those things that you have learned and you're capable of doing.
Yeah.
And I think part of that whole maker movement and maker culture is that, just, like,
I can do it.
Able, yeah. Just say yes.
Yeah. During the winter, the drains get frozen, right? And then my basement started backing up. Like, you know, I came down and there was all black water outside. And I was like, oh shit, like, now this is like a $500 expense for me, or maybe more. Like, you know, $500 is a minimum they charge just to get to your house. And you know what? I said, I'm going to try and do this myself, because apparently I am a maker, right? So, and I went and I rented the equipment from Home Depot, and I got my hands dirty, and I broke my fingers, but I I didn't break my fingers. I almost did. But I learned, right? I learned. And I solved the problem. And I was like so proud of myself, smelling of like shit. But it was fine. You know, that's the whole empowerment thing that I think really drives.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's a very, very good example of something that is you know, something that is... I don't want to say required, but it's something that really empowers you because it's a knowledge that can be useful every day.
Yeah.
And in the simplest situations, you know. And you know what? Like, and from my experience at least, one success leads to another. And you got to focus on that first win. Just get your first win when it comes to fixing something or repairing something or just overcome one challenge. And I think that's enough to propel you forward to overcome the next one and the next one and the next one. And before you know it, you know, you don't need to build phones, smartphones, and like build computers. You don't need to do that, but you can definitely cover your basics at least.
Yeah. And I think I took that away from you because I seen you working and you were like kind of this fearless person, like, okay, let's do it. And I was like, what the? Yeah. Let's just do it. Come on. And like, you just go ahead and like, build these humongous things and just take it. And I was like, okay.
I'm just not afraid to fail. I think that's a really important thing to remember.
Yeah.
Failure is not something to run away from or escape from. It's something that, that's the most learning experience you can get is when something fails.
Yeah. And it's not also failure. It's also confidence of being safe, right? Like I was just afraid even of using a power tool sometimes, like, you know,
right.
And I mean, over time you like, once you have mastered one or you actually understand what is actually happening, you can actually deal with the other ones. But till you have not had that first-hand experience, I mean, I don't know. It's difficult, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's true. Like you know, there's a risk. Obviously there's a risk, but I don't know. I think it's a reasonable risk if you take things slow and don't, you know, if you don't know how to use something, don't just go ahead and use it. Try to ask someone or check YouTube videos or do some research on how to use it. But once you have the basics, don't be afraid to try.
Yeah. And I mean, that's how you've been, like, you've been running, you know, the Maker Lab at OCAD, the Makerspace. And I think, you know, giving new students that confidence to actually do things, because a lot of us come there without much experience in actually working with power tools, right? Like, you know,
right.
Working with fabrication equipment.
Right.
And so, like, you know, just giving them that confidence saying, okay, you can do it. I'm here if you need my help is like really important, right?
Absolutely. So I really believe in that. I believe in empowerment and I believe in just letting you do you and letting you figure it out. And I'm there in case, you know, there's something dangerous or something you don't know or whatever, but it's really important that you venture into it on your own terms, you know?
Yeah. Omar, would you like to add anything to that conversation?
I completely agree with what Matt said. It's really just about that whole experience, just being able to do it yourself and having that failure positive attitude towards doing something. That even from your, I think it goes back to what I said about like being having the ability to reflect on what you have done. Part of it is that being able to reflect on something that's gone wrong, let's say.
Yeah.
But just not gone the way that you wanted it to go or
exactly,
the way that you expected it to go, but still being able to learn from that mistake. Like, unless you, without trying, you can never really say, like, how are you going to know if you can do something or not if you have never tried it?
Yeah.
And with that trying, I think you build this confidence that lets you move on to the next project and then the next project and then the next project. And it just gets bigger and bigger.
For me, it was a thinking through making class. You know, we did that whole safety training. We were not even allowed to touch the equipment till we did all the training on all the different equipment. And we didn't do that in the start of OCAD, and still we engaged with the equipment, you know. But when I did the one through thinking through making, that one was really like, it was more thorough and it felt like okay, now I understand, like, if I do this, this can happen to me, or why am I putting these safety glasses on, or why am I doing this? Like, you know, that why was answered for me, and that has carried me forward in so being safe in so many circumstances. And it was like a 1 hour class. And I really hope that, you know, we have adoption in the digital future space to actually bring that on earlier in the process.
You know, it's not just like the use of manual tools, but also like the digital ones, like the 3D printer and the laser cutter. We kind of got introduced to them, but when we had the digital fabrication course, which was already after we done most of our experimental building and creation computation, which I think was sad. Looking back now, I think if I knew how to use devices beforehand, it would have changed a lot of different things about my projects, but also at the same time, because I got to use like a 3D printer for the research stuff that I did, and I got to know how the printer works really, it gave me a much better understanding of when I should use it or how I should use it. And I think that deeper understanding of the tools that we have at our hand is something that's missing from most people. And it really affects the kind of things that we do and like how well we will use them.
Yeah.
For a lack of a better word, you can say like the efficiency of the tools. But like when I say efficiency, I mean like what they're built to do, and how many percentage of their usefulness are we using?
Yeah. So I think I will wrap it up. I'm really thankful to you guys. I mean, this was a fantastic conversation. I mean, and there's so much of, you know, wealth of information. I mean, you could do another whole podcast talking about, like, you know, our processes. But I think this was great. And
thank you.
And let's see how tomorrow goes. In the first ever Digital Futures virtual gallery exhibition.
Yes.
All of our work is now a flat piece of JPEG. So best of luck to us all, I guess.
Yeah. Thank you, Frank.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you for having us. This was awesome, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was good.
So that brings us to the end of our podcast. That was the last in the series. And thank you for listening. And please check out our website at dfthesis.com. Thanks.